previously on Bad Cops. An elite unit of police officers has gone rogue in the city of Baltimore. They're called the Gun Trace Task Force, and their leader is Sergeant Wayne Jenkins. Their job is to get illegal guns off the streets, but they've also been planting evidence, framing people, stealing money and drugs.
I was robbed by Baltimore City police, you know, robbed with a gun, armed robbery.
FBI Special Agent Erica Jensen has been on their tail for months. In an attempt to catch them red-handed, she set a trap, a motorhome stuffed full of cash. She was hoping the cops would steal the money, but they didn't fall for it. They seemed to smell a rat, and Agent Jensen was forced to pull the plug.
I knew if we got discovered that we might lose the whole case. The whole case might fall apart.
But despite her disappointment, Agent Jensen can now see just how jumpy these officers in the unit have become. I'm Jessica Lussenhop, and you're listening to Bad Cops on the BBC World Service, the true story of Baltimore's Gun Trace Task Force. Part 5, The Takedown. FBI agent Erica Jensen has been investigating the Gun Trace Task Force, an elite plainclothes unit of the Baltimore Police Department that she knows is deeply corrupt. On wiretaps, she's heard them talking about how they might be under investigation. And as their suspicions grow, Agent Jensen has to tread carefully. She still got the wiretap running on one of the cops' cell phones. And she's hearing the task force officers say a lot of stuff that they shouldn't be.
What's up, Jay?
That's Sergeant Wayne Jenkins, leader of the Gun Trace Task Force, calling one of his officers, Detective Mamadou Gondo.
We had it down now. We got the package.
We got the package. Gondo means the guy he's got handcuffed in the backseat of his car. Earlier that evening, Gondo and his partner, Jamel Rayum, were secretly watching the man and his wife as they shopped for blinds at a Home Depot in northwest Baltimore. The couple were on their way home when the task force officers stopped them.
Okay, hey, did you tell them anything at all?
No.
Jenkins tells Gondo he's on his way. And then...
All right, just tell him you gotta wait for the U.S. attorney who's like, hey, sir, how are you? We got our target in pocket. And then you can introduce me as the U.S. attorney.
I got you.
All right, dog.
When I get there, introduce me as the U.S. attorney. That's another Jenkins ploy, claiming to be a prosecutor or a DEA agent. The idea is to intimidate a suspect, make them think they're in much bigger trouble than they really are. And using this tactic, Jenkins is planning to lean on the guy handcuffed along with his wife in the back of Gondo's car. His name's Ronald Hamilton, and the unit's been watching him for a while. He served time for drug dealing, and he's been out of prison a couple of years. But according to an informant, Ronald Hamilton is back dealing drugs. And if he is, he could be what Jenkins calls a monster, a big-time dealer sitting on a pile of cash and drugs, the perfect target for the unit to rip off. When Jenkins arrives minutes later, he grills Hamilton. But the whole U.S. Attorney Act, it doesn't work. Hamilton is adamant he doesn't sell drugs anymore. He sells used cars, and he's got the receipts to prove it. Jenkins doesn't believe him, so he sticks the Hamiltons in the backseat of his car, and the whole unit heads for their house in the suburbs. When they arrive, they find the Hamiltons' children in the house. They order them out. Then, Jenkins and his officers go inside. In a bedroom, they find $70,000 in cash, and they take $20,000 of it. They also pocket a super high-end wristwatch. But they've found nothing illegal.
Ram walks out the front door with the $20,000 in a bag and slips Hamilton his business card. Hamilton is flabbergasted. And later, once he discovers his money is missing, he texts Ram, "You robbed me." A few hours later, Ram realizes he's also missing some of Hamilton's money. He's just counted it and they're $3,000 short. So he calls his partner and buddy, Mamadou Gondo.
Yo, real talk. I'm counting.
No,
counting.
Negative. I will never, come on, man.
Hey, I'm gonna count it again, yo. I'm gonna count it again, yo.
Hey, I will never
let you know.
It's me.
Hey, bro, well, I'm just letting you know it's a mistake.
I don't make mistakes, count money.
I'm letting you know. All right, man. Hey,
unless they did something in the car.
Okay, brother. All right. I don't got no reason to lie, man. I'm just letting you know, yo. All right.
This is something Agent Jensen hasn't heard before. It seems the task force officers now can't even trust each other.
Someone skimmed some money off the top of that $20,000. And it just wasn't how we thought that they were with each other. Like, they wouldn't have taken money from each other like that, because when they go to split it, now the split is less.
FBI Special Agent Jensen has been piecing together the crimes of the Gun Trace Task Force from wiretaps, but also from listening to the jail calls of people the unit's been arresting. She's hoping to identify victims without approaching them directly as another precaution against leaks. But despite Jensen's best efforts, there's a suspicion creeping through the squad, a feeling that they're being watched. And it's around this time that the unit's leader, Sergeant Wayne Jenkins, steps away. He takes 3 months of paternity leave. It's good timing for Jenkins. It gives him an opportunity to let things cool off. And without him, the rest of the crew seems to slow down. The kind of criminal activity Agent Jensen is used to hearing almost stops. She knows there's no point in waiting any longer. It's time to pull the trigger. It's also now time, finally, to brief the Baltimore Police Department's top brass on what their golden boys have really been up to, and to start plotting their takedown. Arresting police officers is a potentially deadly task. Agent Jensen doesn't know what the officers might be capable of if they're backed into a corner. They're armed, and they've all got a lot to lose. What if they try to make a run for it? Or turn their weapons on themselves, or even on others?
We were concerned about things like suicide by police or other reactions.
Agent Jensen is hoping she can avoid the worst-case scenario. So, working with the Baltimore Police Department leadership for the first time, they come up with a ruse. Soon after Wayne Jenkins is back from paternity leave, he gets a call. It's from the Department of Internal Affairs, the division of the Baltimore Police Department that investigates its own officers. He's told there's a complaint against him. It's something trivial, nothing to worry about. They've found some damage on one of the unmarked cars he's been using. They just need Jenkins and the rest of his unit to give an explanation for the damage so they can close the case. He'll be motivated to sort it out. He's been gunning for promotion to lieutenant, and he won't get it with a complaint hanging over him. But it's a trap. It's early morning, March 1st, 2017. The sky is still pitch black when the FBI SWAT team sneaks into Internal Affairs headquarters. This is it. The day FBI Special Agent Erica Jensen and her team have been working towards all these months. It's also one of the most precarious moments of the whole investigation. She's nervous, worried that the task force officers might sense something.
I don't know that we all thought everyone would show up, but we were certainly concerned that they had advance notice.
To her frustration, Erica is not where the action is.
My role was to be at the command post. It's not the most desirable place to be, but that's where the case agent ends up.
She's at the FBI base outside the city, monitoring all the moving parts of the operation, feeding information back to her colleagues at the Internal Affairs building. It's 8:45. Wayne Jenkins pulls into the Internal Affairs parking lot. He's right on time.
He enters the lobby, checks his gun. He's then escorted to the elevator, where he takes it up to the second floor. The doors open. Before he can even take a step, he's met by the sight of a heavily armed FBI SWAT team. They scream at him to get his hands up and handcuff him. He's hauled off into a side room. Sergeant Wayne Jenkins, leader of the Gun Trace Task Force, is now in custody. Detective Jamel Ram is the next to arrive. He enters the lobby, checks his weapon, and goes up to the second floor. One after the other, the officers are taken down. Detective Mamadou Gondo arrives last. He's almost 40 minutes late. He strolls into the building dressed in a crisp maroon shirt. He checks in his gun and enters the elevator. Seven officers from the elite Gun Trace Task Force, one of the crown jewels of the Baltimore Police Department, are now in custody, held in separate rooms. But at the FBI command post outside the city, Agent Jensen doesn't feel like it's a time to celebrate.
You know, you're relieved that all of them showed up, but then we still had lots more work ahead of us.
With her at the command post is the Baltimore Police Department's top cop, Commissioner Kevin Davis. He's been watching the operation unfold alongside her. With all of the unit now under arrest, Commissioner Davis makes his way to the Internal Affairs building.
I told the FBI that I wanted to look each and every one of these guys in the eye. I wanted them to see the disgust and disappointment, and frankly, the anger and outrage on my face.
He goes from room to room, saying nothing. The officers either drop their eyes or look away. Finally, he gets to the room where Sergeant Wayne Jenkins is being held. It's less than a year since he awarded Jenkins the Bronze Star for bravery.
I'll never forget it. He's a big guy, so they used two sets of handcuffs. And I remember taking two or three steps into the room. I was probably 5 or 6 feet away from Wayne Jenkins, and I stared him right in the eye, and he didn't do what the other detectives did. He didn't look away. He didn't look at his feet. He looked right back at me, right into my eyes, right through me, as if to say, F you.
Now to a shocking corruption scandal in Baltimore. Seven police officers indicted on federal charges.
One sergeant and six detectives, all at some point assigned to the department's Gun Trace Task Force, are in handcuffs.
Today they were arrested and photographed by the police department before taken to federal court.
This case started a year ago after digging into a separate drug conspiracy investigation involving one of those accused officers. Turns out that was just the tip of this criminal iceberg.
They were even wiretapped by the FBI. The U.S. attorney involved is calling this a major abuse of power.
This kind of conduct by police officers tarnishes the reputation of all police officers.
Commissioner Kevin Davis calls them the lowest of the low.
These officers, they're 1930 style gangsters, as far as I'm concerned.
At the time the news breaks, Gary Brown is sitting at home watching TV. It's been 8 years since he went to Internal Affairs to complain that he'd been robbed by a bunch of cops. One of them, Detective Jamel Ram from the Gun Trace Task Force. Now, 8 years later, he's watching the news and learning that the same cop that robbed him has been arrested.
And his face popped up, and I said, that's him. That's the guy that took my money. And you know, you telling people that the police took some money from you, they like, oh man, go ahead. You talking on the side of your head. You know, nobody, you know, believe me. You know, this guy was working under Baltimore City for years.
Nearly 2,000 kilometers away in Oklahoma, a man named Umar Burley is also watching TV, sitting in the rec room of a federal prison. He's serving a 15-year sentence after he was arrested by Sergeant Wayne Jenkins. When the news flashes up on the screen, Burley, or Little Baltimore, as he's known inside, isn't really paying attention until the other inmates call him over.
The guys in there said, "Little Baltimore, a bunch of police officers from the task force just got arrested for doing a lot of crazy stuff. You should check that out."
On the screen, he sees the man who helped put him away. Burley tries not to get his hopes up. He's told his story about Jenkins many times, but no one has ever believed him.
I didn't want to get too excited because this thing been going on for a while and I didn't know if it's real or not.
Until he was shipped off to a federal prison, Umar Burley spent his whole life in Baltimore.
At first, I was an all-A student. And then I would say it was my high school years. Street influence became a bigger part of my life. The girls trying to be the popular guy. So I began to hang with the wrong crowd and I began to cut school and get into other things. And that's when it all started.
Burley says he got caught up in a drug case involving his uncle and spent years in juvenile detention. As an adult, he got deeper into the drug game and was arrested multiple times. But it was an incident in April 2010 that would land Umar Burley in federal prison. He was sitting in his car with his cousin when an unmarked car pulled up in front of him, and then a second vehicle tried to block him in. Behind the wheel of one of the cars was Wayne Jenkins. The officers jumped out, guns drawn. Burley insists he had no idea they were cops.
I didn't know who it was. I panicked, and I just took off.
And the other two cars gave chase. He was flying through a stop sign when, at the last second, he saw another car pull into his path.
So I tried to turn away from the car, and the car actually turned the same way I'm turning, so boom.
The other driver was 86-year-old Albert Davis, on his way home from visiting one of his children. His wife was sitting alongside him. Albert Davis was killed, and his wife was badly injured. As paramedics were trying to save the couple, Wayne Jenkins and the other officers at the scene were busy searching the wreckage of Burley's car. They pulled out 32 grams of heroin.
And I was like, man, I had 32 grams of nothing in my car. I didn't have anything in my car.
From the moment he was arrested, Umar Burley insisted the drugs were not his. They were planted. But that's the kind of story that gets little sympathy from prosecutors. They've heard it 1,000 times before. Burley had no proof. And he was a repeat offender who had just killed someone while trying to outrun the cops. The best option, the prosecutor told him, was to plead guilty and hope for a short sentence. If he pled not guilty at trial and lost, he might spend the rest of his life behind bars.
She said, "You will be old and gray, probably not even be able to walk before you get out, if you come out."
So Umar Burley pled guilty to manslaughter and drug charges. He was sentenced to 15 years in federal prison.
What was it like to say that, to have to stand in front of a courtroom and say that you did those things?
It was hard, but it was a must, because I know if I didn't do it, then I would never see the light of day. You know, I would never walk the streets again. So, you know what I mean? It was a hurtful and a painful thing, but I knew there was nothing I could do and no one to help me to get out of it.
With the officers from the Gun Trace Task Force now in custody, the work for investigators and prosecutors is only just getting started. Similar cases in the past collapsed because the officers simply stuck together, refusing to admit anything. And that's what some of the task force officers vowed to do that first night after their arrest, locked up together in a jail outside Baltimore City. But as they learn just how much evidence the prosecution has against them, some of the officers begin to crack, and they start cooperating. They meet with federal prosecutors, offering up any information they think might help them get more favorable treatment. And one of the first stories offered up is about a car crash, the death of an elderly driver, and 32 grams of planted heroin. Six months after Burley saw Wayne Jenkins' face on the prison TV, prosecutors pay him a visit. It's not the kind of meeting he's expecting. When they walk in, they tell him right away, "We believe you.
We already know that the drugs is planted in your car. And all we want you to do is tell your side of what happened."
But even as his former crew is turning against him, Wayne Jenkins denies that he was the one who planted the drugs in Burley's car that day. So the prosecutors reach out to the other cops at the scene of the fatal accident. One of them is a homicide detective, Sean Suter. At the time of the Burley crash in 2010, Suter was a plainclothes drug detective, like Jenkins. Then he'd gone over to homicide, where he gained a pretty stellar reputation. Defense lawyers and even drug dealers say he was respectful, trustworthy. The kind of cop who didn't harass the neighborhood kids for no reason. He seemed to genuinely care about his job. The FBI reaches out to Suter. They ask him to testify about what he knows in the Umar Burley case. But within a month, Sean Suter will be dead, shot with his own weapon in a dusty vacant lot in West Baltimore.
He was killed the day before he was scheduled to testify in a case against indicted Baltimore officers.
The revelation sends the city of Baltimore into a frenzy of rumor and speculation.
What killed Detective Sean Suter remains an open question for police, prosecutors, and the medical examiner.
Was the timing of Sean Suter's death a coincidence? Was someone trying to stop him from testifying? Or was this tragedy something else altogether? That's next time. You've been listening to Bad Cops on the BBC World Service with me, Jessica Lessenhop. The program was mixed by Neil Churchill, additional mixing by James Beard. The producer is Ben Crichton, and the editor is Richard Varden. Bad Cops is available as a podcast. Search for it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Americans are out, the Taliban in. A generation's work, the dreams of so many, shattered in days.
As we speak, there's Taliban right at my doorstep.
I can't believe the world abandoned Afghanistan. Our friends are going to get killed. They're going to kill us.
In our new podcast, you'll hear from people whose lives have shaped Afghanistan, who wished for and worked for different futures.
I think the biggest mistake that we made as Afghans was to feel that there was somebody else who will take care of everything for us.
A Wish for Afghanistan from the BBC World Service.
Everyone else has the luxury to pack and go. We can't, and we did not create this mess on our own.
Search for A Wish for Afghanistan with Mélisse Doucet, wherever you get your podcasts.